hang around, occupy the airwaves coming up a bit too.
We'll be right back. Okay, welcome, folks.
We like that so much.
Yes, indeed.
We want to hear it again.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay. Okay, hello, folks. Welcome to the April 14, 2012 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air by WFT 90.1 FM Radio in Champaign, Illinois, and webcast worldwide at WFT.org. The views and opinions expressed during this hour program and those of the speaker do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WFT's management, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, call area code 217-469-6111. It's 469-6111. And this hour of programming is brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice of labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support Community Radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us later in the show, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's brand new poem for the week is entitled An Ode to the Uncounted, and he'll recite it later in the show. Also with us today is Bill Gorell, co-founder of the Illinois World Labor Hour, and Pat Simpson. So now here's Tom to kick off some workers' interest news.
With Illinois facing strangling debt from the money it owes to retirement funds, a top Democrat is seeking to amend the state constitution to make it more difficult for legislators to boost public employee pensions in the future. The amendment House Speaker Michael Madigan proposed this week would require three-fifths votes in the House of Representatives and the Senate to enhance retirement benefits for public employees, and similar vote counts by city councils or school boards to sweeten perks for certain employees. If the lawmakers and Governor Pat Quinn approve, voters will decide in November whether to make it a part of our Constitution. Illinois owes about $80 billion to its five public employee pension systems because of decades of underfunding. Madigan has promoted several recent measures to ease the financial burdens, such as reducing benefits for new employees. This latest proposal, a constitutional amendment, is aimed at dozens of bills introduced over the years to sweeten government workers' pensions. The largest state employees' union, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, are stringently opposing Madigan's plan.
Okay, Bill, do you have any news items? Or?
Okay. Actually, I have something. I happen to be teaching an online course on unions and social movements, and we are talking a lot about the undocumented. And this story was, I thought particularly appropriate to be talking about the real war at the border. Headline: Two immigrants were killed in ambush by Arizona gunmen. Two people were killed on Sunday night when an unknown number of subjects in camouflage clothing, armed with rifles, ambushed a truck carrying 20 to 30 undocumented immigrants near the southern Arizona town of Eloy. Border Patrol agents and police found one body in the bed of the pickup truck and the other nearby in the desert. The identities of the victims have not been released. Five other border crossers were found hiding in nearby brush and were turned over to Border Patrol after being questioned. The rest managed to escape into the desert on foot. Gosh knows what might be happening to them. When asked if investigators suspect the attack was orchestrated by a militia, Sheriff's Department spokesman Deputy Don Barkman said, "Investigators are, quote-unquote, looking into every possibility, but nothing is conclusive." The truck carrying the immigrants was traveling in a wash that is commonly used for human smuggling, according to the sheriff's department. A wash is a river in the desert that is often without water. The attack comes as the Arizona legislature is considering a bill that could create a volunteer, state-sponsored, and fully armed militia to aid the border patrol along the United States-Mexico border. Militia members would be able to pursue, arrest, and detain individuals. The 300-person militia would cost taxpayers $1.4 million annually and would be under the control of the governor. Crossing the border can be a dangerous task beyond the threat of attack. Immigrants often die of dehydration or malnutrition while crossing the harsh Sonora Desert and attempting to avoid arrest. The humanitarian aid group No More Deaths has documented 71 deaths of immigrants attempting to cross the Mexico-Arizona border area since October of 2011. All I can say is this reminds me of that very moving song by Woody Guthrie, Los Deportees. We bring people in, we create circumstances that essentially attract workers to the United States, and what we offer to them on the other side are militias. And we know, given what we've seen happening in Florida in the Martin case, that men with guns, women with guns for that matter, that have basically an open license to kill will do so.
Okay, thank you, Pat. And looks like trade unions in mining, energy, and manufacturing sectors around the world have basically formed their members into a new global union called the Industrial All Global Union. I guess there's a conference coming up for that in Copenhagen, Denmark, between June 18th and June 20th. And political leadership will be decided at the Copenhagen conference. I guess the Industrial All, as it's called, will represent workers in a wide range of sectors, from extraction of oil, mining, generation, and distribution of electric power, to manufacturing metals, and shipbuilding, chemical garments, pulp and paper, leather, and many other products. New organization's website will include useful information and relevant documents for participants, and the Industrial All's flag is expected to be planted on Mount Everest in a new expedition that will begin April 3rd, which I guess has already begun. Tom?
According to a report from the Associated Press, the outlook for American economic growth is looking slightly better. American businesses sold a record number of goods and services in Europe and China and other foreign markets in the month of February, while imports to the U.S. declined. However, our economy still has a long way to go to get back to full health. More people applied for unemployment benefits last week, and that news followed last week's report that hiring had slowed in March after 3 months of strong job growth. The mixed economic picture, along with low inflation, cited in another report, gives the Federal Reserve more ammunition to stick with its plan to hold interest rates near record lows when it meets later this month. The U.S. trade deficit narrowed more than 12% in February to some $46 billion, which was down from $52.5 billion in January, which was the largest deficit in 3.5 years. Exports rose to a record $181.2 billion, while imports dropped to $227.2 billion. More exports helped our economy grow because they typically boost factory production, which should fuel more hiring and lead to greater consumer spending. And fewer imports impede growth much less because consumers are spending their dollars here where they should. Pat?
And on the international front, the Irish are making some trouble once again. March 31st marked the deadline for Irish households to register and pay a new property tax, the latest deficit-reducing initiative introduced by the government at the behest of its bailout partners, including the usual suspects, European Union, European Central Bank, and the IMF. But in cities like Dublin and Waterford and across rural towns from West Cork to Donegal, a network of can't-pay, won't-pay groups have called on citizens to boycott this unjust tax. The grassroots movement was initiated by political organizations from across the left, and that includes trade unionists and residents' associations. And the campaign has spread like wildfire. Local campaigns recently elected delegates to form a national steering committee. An unemployment rate of 14%, singeing cuts to local services, and stalled economic growth have sown seeds of discontent. Town hall meetings on this issue have regularly drawn crowds of several hundred people. A recent gathering in Dublin attracted 3,000. The movement has found residents across all sectors of Irish society uniting financially stressed communities. So there is, like in Greece, some pushback in terms of what has gone on as a result of the financial crisis.
Okay, thank you, Pat. And some more interesting news from the international scene. It looks like that this is just such a strange story. 22 Indonesian maids are on death row now in Saudi Arabia and have been, some of them have been returned to their home in Indonesia. Some 25 more maids still face the death penalty after being found guilty of quote-unquote criminal offenses. Indonesian officials will meet in Saudi Arabia to discuss the fate of the remaining maids. About 1,700 Indonesian nationals currently serve prison terms in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Indonesian embassy, as well as a Jeddah-based consulate, are trying to secure pardons for the imprisoned maids. It was reported, Indonesia has banned recruitment agencies from sending maids to work in Saudi Arabia, and the nation's legal system does not do enough to protect foreign workers. This is strange. I wonder what some 40, almost 50 maids could have done to be put on death row in Saudi Arabia. Of course,
well, in that part of the world, I'm sure it didn't take much.
Yeah, and remember, see, Saudi Arabia is supposed to be the shining beacon example of what the Arab world should be, according to the people who control our government, the State Department.
Actually, it's very interesting, too, because this follows on the heels of a couple of years ago where there were cases of Saudi women who, in fact, murdered their maids. And indeed, I think in Indonesia, there was a movement by the government to stop essentially doing what they could to restrict immigration from their country to Saudi Arabia to provide domestic service. So I don't know. Is this retaliation?
That's a good question. Okay, Tom?
Hey, according to a recent report from the Illinois Department of Agriculture, 17% of corn statewide has already been planted. That figure is way ahead of this time last year when only 5% had been planted. And that's way ahead of the five-year average of only 1% for this point in the growing season. In Illinois' East Central region, which includes Champaign, Vermilion, Payette, Ford, and Iroquois counties, only about 10% of the corn crop has been planted. Many farmers in this region report that they need a bunch more rain. Throughout those cornfields, topsoil moisture was rated short by 64%, adequate by 33%, and very short by 3%. Subsoil moisture was rated short by 49%, adequate by 47%, and very short by 4%. It appears that we could get record crops this year, but only if we get the rains that are needed. And if you look out your window right now, that might be a beginning.
Okay, tune in next week for Tom Thomas's Farm Report here on WFT's Illinois World Labor Hour. Brought to you by the Union of Organic Gardeners and Growers of America.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, good enough. We're going to go to a little music from Utah Phillips, and we'll be right back. Yeah!
Lived in the little town of West Seattle on the other side of Puget Sound. Little tiny house, little bitty kitchen. He was a Norwegian immigrant, gave all of his life to the logging and to the union. He carried his red card in the union every working day of his life. We sat in that little kitchen and he told me the story of the Spokane Free Speech Fight, 1910. I would not attempt to duplicate that rumbling baritone voice or that Norwegian accent, but this is the story, the way he told it. He said, "Oh, they boomed into Spokane and towns all over the West, looking for work in the silver mines up in the Coeur d'Alene's or in the logging camps or in the wheat harvest, the 110 cats, the great wheatlands that flow away south of Spokane called the Palouse. Well, you jungle up in the flops, wait for the weather to break, and then you go down on the street on Trent Avenue, and there were these rows of little shops called Labor Sharks. Well, Labor Sharks hold jobs. You give a Labor Shark $4, and it entitled you to a job, say, putting down a new mine shaft up in the Coeur d'Alene. Well, you'd boom up there to that job, burning up your road stake as you went. You get up there, work a month, get paid, and then fired. Why? Because the foreman on the job was splitting the labor fees with the shark in town. But crooked as hell, they called it perpetual motion, where you had one job, one worker going to the job, one worker on the job, one worker coming back to buy another damn job. Well, he said that the union, the Wobblies, IWW, they came into those towns all over the West in Spokane and to build union hiring halls to control the conditions of their labor. Well, the one in Missoula, Montana was burned down. The one in Spokane was torn down by the law. So the Wobblies went down on the street, and they put up soap boxes, and they get up on the soap box and start windmilling, street speaking, exhorting, and they'd always set up right across the street from the Starvation Army. Me over there, Bible banging and Jesus preached and telling these working folks that to give what they had to Jesus to get pie in the sky by and by. My, my, that's a lie. Well, they were good at it. People flocked across the street to join a fighting union, which offers a more immediate form of salvation than the standard garden variety. Scared the tar out of the city and out of the bosses, so they passed an ordinance against free speech, against speaking openly on the street. Applied to everybody except the Salvation Army. Now, that's intolerable. We all know that the state can't give you free speech, and the state can't take it away. You're born with it, like your eyes, like your ears. Huh? We all understand that. Like old Campbell said, freedom is something you assume. Then you wait for somebody to try to take it away from you. The degree to which you resist is the degree to which you are free. So they said, okay, we're going to resist. They sent out a call to anybody cut loose from a job in the whole territory. They flooded into town on the freight trains, filled it up, put that soapbox up on Trent Avenue in defiance of the law. Built a line four blocks down and four blocks up, and every one of those booming workers took their turn up on that soapbox. Had time enough to say, fellow workers, and they got arrested. Well, that was the idea, of course, to fill the jails. The Finnish workers, they were the tough ones. The Finnish immigrants were socialists when they got here. The Finnish worker learned enough English to be able to say, fellow workers, and if the cop wasn't right there, say, where's that damn cop? Well, they filled the city jail, filled the county jail, filled the sports arena, all the high school gyms, grade school gyms. Every square inch of public space was full of busted boomers. But then the city had to feed them. The tax burden was enormous. And the taxpayers balked and said, we're not going to spend our hard-earned loot to feed that bunch of grimy grifters down in the slammer. So they had to change the ordinance. And they won. And it didn't take any ballot boxes, and it didn't take any political parties. It's called direct action, and comes to us highly recommended.
We now come to that point in the Illinois World Labor Hour for the Cultural Corner with Tom Thomas's brand new poem of the week, An Ode to the Uncounted.
Some think we are recovering from this recession that we're in, but ultimately they will weep when they learn that they just can't win. The unemployed are not counted when they have to stop seeking work because there are just no jobs left for plumber, carpenter, or clerk. Some think that unemployment is diminishing throughout our land. That is as false can be, and many know who took a stand. Those many chose to occupy this grand land that belongs to them. Their impetus is bringing light to brighten that which has been dim. Each time that percentile number is flashed upon your TV screen, just know that it's not accurate. The jobless know the truth they've seen. Greedy bankers and CEOs and crooked politicians don't really care who starves to death as long as they are patricians. Those tyrants are eternal foes of a class that chose to be free. So support the occupiers and we'll be free eventually. And Ode to the Uncounted was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on April 10th, 2012, and was brought to you live today, April 14th, 2012, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, Community Radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Got some public service announcements here. Tune in this Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. for Labor's Worldview television program. And also today at Westside Park at 12:30, hopefully weather permitting, the local Champaign-Urbana Occupy is going to be having a picnic there. And that's at Westside Park at 12:30 this afternoon, I guess, weather permitting. And also, big event coming up here this coming Thursday, April 19th. There's going to be a rally and demonstration against Mitch Daniels, the Republican governor of Indiana, who's speaking at the Hilton Gardens on the corner of Neal Street and Kirby, who's invited by the Champaign County Republican Party to speak on Hitler's birthday, of all things. I wonder if there's a connection there. But anyway, people are going to be coming from all over the state of Illinois, Indiana, Missouri, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Kentucky. This is going to be huge, folks. I was at a meeting at the building trades yesterday, and they're expecting over 10,000 people to show up for this. So come on out and show your opposition to the Republicans and the other anti-worker elements out there that we will not allow Illinois to become a right-to-work state. So you can park in the west parking, or actually it's the main parking lot of the assembly hall. There's going, and you can start assembling there about around 3 o'clock. There's going to be a speaker starting to speak at 4, and then people are going to start marching from the assembly hall parking lot to the Hilton Gardens on the corner of Kirby and Neal at about 5:15. So come on out and show your opposition to this program that we do not want here in Illinois. And Pat?
Yeah, this is this upcoming week is really a week for Republican governors in Illinois. I don't know quite what's going on. But on Tuesday, April 17th, there's going to be a We Are One rally in Springfield at the Lincoln Hotel. And Governor Scott Walker is going to be speaking there. He's been invited by the Illinois Chamber of Commerce. Maybe the chamber thinks they may have some good ideas that they can get from Walker, who basically was involved in stripping Wisconsin workers.
Okay. Sounds like our guest is calling in to the labor hour here. Hello, you're on the air. Hello, you're on the air.
This is Kim Bobo. I was called to call in at 11:25.
Yes, you're on the air, Kim. Thank you so much for calling in. This is David Johnson, one of the hosts of the Illinois World Labor Hour, and we're here. Pat Simpson's sitting right next to me.
Excellent. Hi, guys.
Hi, Kim. So glad to hear you speaking to us. I've been an admirer of you for a long time.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Okay. Well, I tell you what. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and the organization that you've been involved in for quite some time here.
Okay. I am a longtime Chicagoan, not originally from here, from Cincinnati, Ohio. But I came to Chicago to work for the Midwest Academy, which is a training center for community organizers, and through that work really got involved with the labor movement, and I had always done a lot of work through the religious community and my church, and was really just appalled at how few connections there were between the labor movement and the religious community, and how those of us who were involved in soup kitchens or shelters, we all knew that the reasons people were in soup kitchens or shelters was because they either didn't have a job or they didn't have a job that paid enough. And yet, as the religious community, we weren't really engaged in those questions of pay and work and so forth. So I started initially in 1991. I put together a group in Chicago of religious leaders to be involved in labor issues, which has sort of grown and become renamed and is now Arise Chicago. And then in 96, I started Interfaith Worker Justice with the mission of engaging people of faith around the country in low-wage worker issues, and have really been doing that ever since. And so, you know, the work has grown in some amazing ways and somewhat different ways than I originally thought. But I feel like we've really made an impact in terms of engaging religious folks in worker issues.
Well, I guess there is somewhat of a historical tradition for this. I was mainly thinking of Dorothy Day and the Catholic worker people and stuff. But evidently, I guess there was this type of focus for religious communities, some religious communities, I should say, had tapered off a little bit. Do you have any comments on that as far as
Well, absolutely. Historically, there were incredibly deep ties between the religious community and the labor community, particularly in the period from the 1930s to the 50s, right? That was really the growth period for the labor movement. You saw incredible engagement of the Catholic Church. There were about 200 Catholic labor schools that were kind of like, teaching people how to organize unions in the basement of the parish, right? I mean, they were just, to be Catholic and to organize in labor were one and the same, really. Similarly, you saw incredible support in the Jewish community. There were what's referred to as the Jewish labor lyceums. Again, they were kind of like the Catholic labor schools, right? They were a place where Jewish immigrants got together, supported one another, and frankly, organized unions. Now, many of the Protestant churches didn't have quite as strong of a tradition, but again, you see incredible leadership that has come out of many of the Protestant churches as well on labor issues. So, again, the ties were really strong. I think what really divided things really began in the 60s. There were real divisions between some of the progressive religious folks over the role of the U.S. in Vietnam, in the Vietnam War. And even though there were plenty of labor unions that opposed the war, as a whole, the labor movement was seen or perceived anyway as supporting the war, and that created real divisions. And then there were some divisions around the role of the U.S. in Central America. And then I think for just a lot of people in the religious community, as the labor unions and the percent of workers in unions declined, people just didn't know unions very well. And increasingly, people who go into clerical leadership, become priests or ministers or rabbis, don't come out of working class families, and so again, don't have ties with unions. And so I think a lot of what had happened really in the 80s and early 90s, people just didn't know labor, particularly people in religious leadership, unless they happen to be older. And so when we came on the ground in the mid-90s, we really spent an awful lot of time talking with the religious community about what is a union, right? And why do people join unions? And why are they so important, not only for groups of workers individually, but for the society at large, right? The important role that unions play in raising overall standards in the society. And similarly, we had played a huge role in helping the labor movement recognize that the religious community really cared a lot about these economic justice issues. And frankly, our involvement made a huge difference when workers tried to organize.
Okay, and in recent years, has there been much involvement from the Islamic community?
Absolutely. You know, when we first started, there wasn't much involvement in the Islamic community. But frankly, my board realized that this was a growing community and an important community in terms of the religious landscape. And so we began in 2000, 1999 and 2000, we began doing a series of trainings on, what does Islam say about about workers' rights? And actually had a training scheduled in Washington, D.C. On 9/11. And ended up having to cancel it, of course, but, our involvement began before that. But I think that really, 9/11 and the whole feeling of in the Islamic community, the Muslim community, of being, not connected as much as they needed to be, really created an environment where it's been really great and easy to build partnerships because the Muslim community really is eager to work with people and figure out how to connect folks. And you've also seen in the last 20 years, really, a change in who are Muslim immigrants in the country. So for many years, Muslim immigrants came and they were engineers or doctors or, you know, they were highly professional folks. But increasingly, immigrants who are Muslim are as likely to be cab drivers or hotel workers or folks who really need unions compared to, you know, more professional immigrants. So, you know, again, we've seen just a lot of involvement around the country of the Muslim community. It's been very exciting.
Kim, if we could pick your brain for a moment here, we have...
I can barely hear you. Can you speak up a little?
I'm sorry. I actually was away from the mic. We here in Champaign-Urbana do not have a chapter or affiliate of the Interfaith Worker Justice, but we do have a Jobs with Justice chapter, and we are interested in reaching out once again. There was some effort and coalition and bridges that were created with the religious community in our town around the living wage campaigns a few years back. But from your point of view, if we could ask for a little technical assistance here, how do you go about organizing the religious community? What do you say to them? We understand they're interested in economic justice, but what kinds of pitches, if you will, do you have to offer to them to make them realize how important being involved in efforts on behalf of low-wage workers are?
Well, I think most people in the religious community, and certainly religious leaders, they want to help, right? I mean, you should assume people want to help, and they particularly want to help in ways that are going to provide direct and immediate benefit for people who are hurting. They don't really care nearly as much about sort of ideological, theoretical positions as they do about concretely helping. So that's number one. Secondly, you should assume that many people in the religious community don't know anything about labor unions, or even worse, what they think about labor unions is completely determined by what the newspapers say, which, you know, might make you think that all labor unions are mobsters, right? I mean, that's how the Chicago Tribune portrays labor on a regular basis. So again, they, you know, they're influenced by that in a way that, you know, they may not even have a neutral position. They may come to the conversation with a slightly negative view, but it's not really informed by a lot. And so you can't have an ideological line, i.e. you have to completely support unions in every way in order to be involved in this. So you have to, you know, it has to be about people and has to not be ideological. And thirdly, you have to be very careful that it's not viewed as partisan, because most congregations are filled with Republicans and Democrats. And so, you know, they want to make sure that they'll be involved in issues, but they don't want to be involved in things that are viewed as highly, highly partisan. You know, and so, again, you just have to be a little careful about that. But having said that, the most important thing is when there are workers in struggle, right, there's, you know, workers at a hotel or workers at the food service or janitors or workers who are trying to organize or trying to get a decent contract or trying to fight in a, you know, a strike or a locked out situation, the best thing to do is have workers go talk to religious leaders. Here's my story. Here's why I'm trying to get a union. Here's why I'm trying to get a contract. Will you help? And people are willing to help, right? Now, they, you know, they have to, you know, religious leaders like to be involved in planning how they help, right? You can't just tell them you have to do this. Mm-hmm. But they're willing to help. And when they see that it helps and it matters, they love it, right? They just love the involvement. And my experience, that, you know, I've had so many religious folks who've said to me, well, Kim, you know, I don't feel all that good about labor. You know, do you still want me to go talk to these workers? And I'll say, absolutely, go talk to these workers. And they come back and they'll say, well, you know, Kim, I don't feel that good in general about unions, but these guys, they really need a union, right? I mean, it transformed them because it's no longer a theoretical thing. It's a concrete situation. So, again, I just think people want to help in the religious community, and, you know, we got to reach out to them. And, you know, I don't know what are the struggles right now in the Champaign-Urbana area, but You know, assuming they're ones that affect low-wage workers, you know, it's a great time to reach out because the religious community is more cognizant of the economic inequalities and the need to be involved in these job issues than they've been in a long time. So it's really a great time. And, you know, if you want to, like, at some point have more of a conversation about how your Jobs with Justice chapter could reach out to the religious community, we would absolutely love to do that. You know, you can do it either just, you know, informally, that's fine. There's some JWJ chapters that actually have kind of an interfaith committee as part of what they're doing. That's fine, too. But, you know, we really love to work together.
Yeah, your point about this is a good time with many congregations being aware of the issue of income inequality, for example. We have had numerous representatives from religious congregations in Champaign-Urbana step forward and offer support for the Occupy movement, and that is something I think that you're absolutely right needs to be worked with and developed a bit more. And we also have had some religious groups combining in a effort to offset the very negative effects that we're seeing. And I'm sure you've had this issue come up in Chicago and also in some of your affiliates of the secure communities legislation and how that's negatively impacting on immigrant communities and particularly, of course, the undocumented.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the religious community is so good on issues of immigration, right, because our religious texts are so strong, right, that, you know, you were once immigrants, right? Remember the immigrant, care for the immigrant. Mm-hmm. And so even congregations that are have not been involved in other issues, you know, some evangelical congregations that have been reluctant to be involved in some of the economic issues, they are very good on immigration issues. So, in fact, those are great issues to be involved in. And we've found, you know, we've done over the last few years, there's, I guess, 26 worker centers right now that are affiliated with IWJ, and the number one problem the worker centers see is workers who haven't been paid for all their wages, right? We call it wage theft.
Right.
You beat us to the punch. We were going to bring that subject up because that's it's just outrageous. I mean, that this is evidently is happening fairly frequently.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can ask me some more on this in a second. But, you know, what we're seeing on wage theft is this is a no-brainer in the religious community, right? Everybody says people aren't getting paid. Of course they should get paid. Tell us what we can do. And so we're taking groups of religious leaders out to meet with employers who haven't paid people, and really they're praying around them and outside their house and in the middle of their businesses, and frankly, those employers are paying people their wages.
Now, you've written a book that actually is a very excellent and detailed examination of wage theft. Can you, I know it's impossible to summarize all that you have there, but could you talk about wage theft as an issue and what you did discover in the research that you did for your book?
Yeah, no problem talking about wage theft, so stop me if I go on too much here. So wage theft is when an employer illegally underpays workers. This is not just that they don't pay them well, right? It's that they are breaking the law. Now, this happens in a variety of ways, and it's very common practice in some sectors of the society. So there was a huge study done for low-wage workers. These are workers that earn $10 an hour or less. The study found that 1 out of 4 low-wage workers isn't paid the minimum wage. We regularly, in Chicago, in our worker center, see workers who come in from restaurants and they haven't been paid the minimum wage. Second most common thing is not paying workers overtime. So for most workers, and certainly all low-wage workers, if you work more than 40 hours a week, you're supposed to be paid time and a half. But employers just flagrantly disregard that law. 3/4 of low-wage workers who work more than 40 hours aren't paid that overtime, and many middle-income workers aren't either. Now, again, not everybody is covered by overtime, but the vast majority of low-wage workers are covered by overtime. And employers will simply tell folks, well, you know, you're not covered by overtime, or, you know, I don't pay overtime, or, well, if you want overtime, go find another job. Well, in this economy, people are, you know, reluctant to leave a job, if it's at all a job. And so people say to me all the time, well, you know, Kim, I know my employer ought to be paying overtime, but, you know, he doesn't, and at least I've got a job. Well, that's a bad thing, right? They're not paying workers for all their hours. So, you know, a worker has to come set up before they clock in, and then they clock out, and then they work another half hour every day. Well, so you're underpaying workers. Or Walmart, you know, the nation's largest employer, ended up settling a little over 65 class action lawsuits, many of which were for the managers going into the timesheets and shaving off hours. So a worker would say, oh, I work 43 hours. You know, they put it in their timesheet. And the managers would say, I don't want to pay overtime, so I'm going to shave those hours and make it look like they only work 40 hours a week, right? Underpaying workers on a regular basis. Then there's the problem of employers lying about actually having employees. It's payroll fraud, right? They tell the government, oh, these aren't really employees, they're independent contractors. And that not only steals from workers, but it steals from the public coffers and shifts burden onto all of us, the taxpayers, because it means that those employers aren't paying their share of unemployment tax, of workers' compensation, and it exempts those workers from a whole range of workplace laws and protections. So, and it's a huge problem in some sectors, like the back of the house of restaurants, right? So cooks and dishwashers are often called independent contractors, which of course they're not. Mm-hmm. Residential construction workers are often called independent contractors when they actually work for some guy every day at the same time. Again, they're not independent contractors. So that's a huge thing. Then you have day laborers who, like, you know, all have the experience of having worked all day and not getting paid at all. Then there's tip stealing. So about 10% of tipped workers don't get their tips. People put it on the credit card and the employer steals it. So in fact, I tell people all the time, you know, don't pay your tip and credit card on your credit card unless you know that that worker's going to get it. And they say, well, how am I know? Well, just ask, right? Say, hey, you know, if I put it on the credit card, will you get it? And you'll know by how they respond to you on that. I could just go on and on, but there, you know, those are some of the major ways that employers steal wages from workers.
Well, you know, on this same note, the Interfaith Worker Justice Network has had some successes in fighting wage theft, and I think this might be a nice way to talk about the work actually that you do. I mean, above and beyond this research, what happens on the streets, as it were, and in the legislatures? How is Interfaith involved?
Yeah, you know, we've been working on this wage theft issue for a number of years now, and we're really working on it in two primary ways. One is through direct action. So a worker comes in, he or she hasn't gotten paid, and we, you know, take a group of folks to the local restaurant and demand that they pay them, right, through direct action. Our worker center in Chicago collected about, $4 or $5 million in the last few years just through. Are you guys still there?
Yes, we're still here.
Okay, I'm getting a few beeps. I don't know what that's about. So
we can't hear it on this end. I wonder what that is.
You might have an incoming call on your own phone.
The direct action, these worker centers around the country do a huge amount of direct action, and you know, it's just another way of doing enforcement. But you're absolutely right that we've been moving beyond the direct action to also look at how do we create enforcement mechanisms at the local level. And so, for example, in Florida, about a year and a half ago, in Miami-Dade County, the Department of Labor in Florida had been voted out by the state legislature, right? So there really is no state Department of Labor at all in the state of Florida. And so our group really looked at, you know, how can we create a way for, you know, for poor workers who've been cheated of their money to not have to go through a year-long process to get $200 back, but can have sort of a much simpler process. So they created an administrative system for recovering wages within the small business office of the county.
Hmm.
It's paid for by fines that people pay if they get found that they haven't paid workers. And with one staff person in the last year, it recovered over $1 million in unpaid wages and has another $750,000 in the pipeline to recover.
That is very impressive.
Right? Totally a great thing. Well, so then what happened in the state legislature, some of the retail association led by Macy's, I'll have you know, led a campaign to preempt the law to say that counties couldn't do stuff like they'd done in Dade County. So then we had to have a big fight to keep the law in Dade County. But the good news is, one, we won, but also there's a number of other counties in Florida who are looking at doing the same thing. So their attack on it actually prompted other counties to look at how do they create sort of an enforcement mechanism as well. So that is, in fact, a great thing. Then we've got similar efforts really underway around the country. So in Houston, Texas, you know, this is the fourth largest city in the nation, so a very large city. Our interfaith group 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago now, introduced a bill into the city council, again, to create an enforcement mechanism there in Houston. At the state level in Texas last year, they amended the theft of services law in the state to strengthen the ability to bring claims at the state level. We've got a new bill that was introduced in the Colorado state legislature. Now, it went down this year, but it's coming back next year, and they're going to put together a stronger plan for trying to win. In Fayetteville, Arkansas, our interfaith group there pushed and got a mayoral task force on wage theft, and so they've tried to figure out how they can work more closely with the police department on enforcing statewide theft of services laws in the Fayetteville area. Similarly, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, they have a mayoral task force that is now working on some legislation to introduce into the Grand Rapids City Council. So it's really a time of great experimentation, right? What we know for sure is that the current, one, there's a crisis in wage theft. Two, it's harmful for workers. It's harmful for ethical employers, right, because it puts them at competitive disadvantage. It's harmful for communities, and it's clearly harmful for taxpayers when we have wage theft. So, again, trying to stop it is important for all of us. And the current enforcement systems, the combination of the Federal Department of Labor and the State Department of Labor, they're clearly not working. And so we've got to create some new ways and some very accessible ways for workers to be able to file complaints and be able to recover their unpaid wages.
This is really a
moment of great experimentation, and frankly, we're winning on these local campaigns.
This is really incredible achievements you guys have done. And I'm afraid we're just about out of time here. Pat, did you have any last questions? Or Kim, did you have any last comments?
Well, if people want to get connected with Interfaith Worker Justice, you have to go to our website and sign up. We do e-alerts. We'll tell you how you can get involved. It's iwj.org, www.iwj.org.
Okay, well, thank you so much for calling in. This has been a really excellent interview, and keep up the good work.
All right, well, Kim, thanks so much, and thanks for having me.
You bet. Our pleasure. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
The gentlest source, I robbed my wife and son. I turned my back on troubles, troubles I'd begun. I cut a swath of pain and loss in the hallways of my home, in the quiet of my room. I know the things I've done. Say the hammer for the man. Save the hammer for the man. It's the calling of the wretched. It's the rising of the damned. Save the hammer for the man.
was driven from the city. In the wilderness I stand, in the cleansing rain and silence I made my battle plan. Alone I marched towards freedom, leaving footprints across the land, with a vow that's left unspoken, save the hammer for the man.
That's right, folks. Save the hammer for the man. Let's not fight amongst ourselves. But sometimes, you know, you've got to bring up issues sort of within your coalition, if you will. And, Bill, you know, I tuned in last week, the last part of the show, and, man, you brought up some really disturbing points about this whole AFL-CIO credit card thing.
Well, yes, right now I'm looking at the Union Plus website. I'm looking at the About page, and there's a photograph of maybe a couple of dozen really nice people who I guess are the people who run this thing. And I have the Laborer's Platinum card.
Oh boy.
Yeah, it should be the Laborer's Concrete card.
Okay, that's good.
But anyway, I think this is all done through the AFL-CIO Union Privilege, Union Plus, and here's what they say. The AFL-CIO created Union Privilege in 1986 to provide union members and their families with valuable consumer benefits. With Union Plus benefits, your union membership pays at work and at home. By using the collective buying power of unions, we are able to offer valuable discounted products and services exclusively to working families, saving, service, and solidarity. Well, you know, why don't you use this collective buying power and get HSBC, which is the bank you're using, which, by the way, is one of the worst banks, and get them to lower my interest rate from 21.99% to something halfway reasonable.
You know, what's interesting, Bill, is the equivalent of the AFL-CIO in Germany, the Deutsches Gewerkschaftsbund, the DGB, they actually own the second largest bank in Germany. And I'll bet you they have better credit card rates for their members.
Well, you know, why does the AFL-CIO, why don't the unions have their own bank?
Exactly. In fact, you know, if I remember right, Pat.
Amalgamated is, yes, in fact, a union bank that came out of the clothing industry and the old ILGWU.
That's New York City?
Yes, uh-huh. In New York City. Mm-hmm. And it actually was a wonderful enterprise that also was able to build low-cost housing for workers, et cetera. So also taking that pooled money and putting it into very socially constructive investments. But, yeah, why not?
Well, yeah, and then look what happened to it. It became a big thing between when the SEIU and the hotel union was getting together, and it became a big thing when they, I don't know. But it's like a lot of things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's like something like all these elevators around here, they're all cooperatives. And they all started kind of in that, during that progressive time with, mm-hmm, a lot of cooperatives. And in my lifetime, to me, they've just been like some big company.
Well, they cease being cooperatives is what happens.
Yeah, but I mean, they get, you know, and it's like everything else. It's like what's happened to the unions, where they basically, I'm sorry, ma'am, but in a lot of ways, you're just personnel departments for the capitalists. You know, I'm really sick of it right now. Don't have much work going on, and there's two jobs going on right now that at least the last couple of times I went by them on a weekday, they're non-union jobs, real close together, weren't any pickets on.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, just one comment on this. There's a lot of talk these days about reviving cooperative movements, reviving worker-owned enterprises, be it, you know, cooperative gardens in Detroit, et cetera. And I think that this is something that the labor movement, progressive forces within it, actors within it, have to start taking a look at again, returning back to those old models.
Yeah, well, and something, the only thing is what I keep seeing, that's like FS, Farm Services.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be like some kind of a cooperative thing, but all of these things, they always seem to turn into the you get professional managers running them,
mm-hmm,
and then they just turn into another corporation.
Yes, indeed.
You know, and that just happens all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a really good point, Bill. And I mean, it's not like it can't be done. It's not like it hasn't been done in the sense of, you know, the trade unions own their own bank. And gosh, I mean, isn't it about time the trade unions might have their own television network? Yeah. I mean, their own media. I mean, in the old days, like cities like New York and Chicago, there were like dozens of union newspapers out there in probably a 24 languages.
WLS.
WCFL. WCFL.
Yeah, WLS stands for World's Largest Store.
Which is Sears, yeah.
Yeah, and no, actually it was, God, what's that, a big store in Chicago. I can't remember.
Yeah.
And then there was WCFL, Chicago Federation of Labor.
Mm-hmm. And I believe they were the first radio station.